I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ask the Pilot is one of the more popular websites online where Patrick Smith, a pilot and travel writer, answers questions we all have on travel, planes, and more. He's updated his New York Times bestseller with a new edition that looks at what makes traveling so confounding and uncomfortable, what could be done to improve it, and he does a marvelous job at taking us into the cockpit as to how planes fly. The book is called Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections. It's such a good book, one you can't easily put down. Patrick Smith is an airline pilot, air travel writer, and the host of AskThePilot.com. The book is published by Sourcebooks. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Patrick Smith. Mr. Smith, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. I guess I should call you Captain Smith. Is that right?
You can call me First Officer Smith.
Okay.
I'm not actually a captain, and what's the difference?
Yeah.
Funny to bring this up. That's something that's talked about in the book. What is a captain? What is a first officer? What do these people do? There's a lot of misunderstanding as far as the roles that we play in the cockpit.
Yeah, so the first officer is you're the person that, I guess, drives the plane, right?
Well, the first officer is known colloquially as the co-pilot.
I see.
People hear that, and they tend to think that a co-pilot is somehow not a real pilot,
mm-hmm.
not a full-fledged pilot, and that's not true at all. Both the captain and the co-pilot are fully qualified pilots, and we both fly the aircraft hands-on, usually in alternating turns. Our qualifications are essentially identical. What's different is the captain is in charge. Somebody has to be the boss and has a larger paycheck to go along with that. But as far as duties go, as far as the flying, it's split pretty much equally.
And so who decides what role one does? I mean, sometimes you'll be in the cockpit there with someone who might have had, say, less experience than you have. Has that happened?
Well, the way we do it is we take turns. That's really the fairest way to put it.
I
if
see.
I'm flying, say, New York to Paris and back again, the captain will fly the leg to Paris, and I'll be the playing the non-flying pilot role, as we call it,
uh-huh.
and doing a lot of all the ancillary duties. And then on the return trip, I will be the hands-on flying pilot. I'll perform the takeoff and landing and so on, and the captain performs the ancillary roles. What exactly we do in those roles can really vary, and people would be surprised, I think, at how busy a cockpit becomes, even with all of the automation up and running.
Yeah. How long have you been a pilot?
I've been a pilot commercially since 1990.
Yeah. And so you've seen a lot, obviously, in that time, and that's what's fascinating about this book, is that there have been changes, some for the better in terms of safety and the technology. But for the consumer, not all of them have been good. I mean, when you're working, when you're at the airport, say, waiting to board a flight, because you're in uniform, do people come up to you to complain, say, about their experiences?
Oh, sure. And in a lot of respects, you can't blame people for complaining. You know, the tedium and the indignity of modern air travel is well established and duly noted, but just the same, and this is a lot of what the book gets into, I think there's a lot about air travel that people don't appreciate, maybe because they don't understand it or they're so overwhelmed by certain negative aspects of it. I mean, flying is safer now than it's ever been. Commercial aviation has simply never been safer than it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's more affordable than it's ever been. For all of the griping people do about airfares, they're cheaper than they've ever been, and that includes factoring in all of those extra fees that people hate and airlines love. And in a lot of ways, and this is going to sound ridiculous to some people, I think flying is more comfortable than people give it credit for. And what do I mean by that? Hang on, I can
yeah.
hear your hate mail coming already. First and business class on long-haul carriers nowadays is more luxurious than it's ever been. You've got widescreen TV and lie-flat seats and pajamas and all you can eat and drink. Even in economy class, for all of the complaining that people do about legroom and crowded cabins, you know, you've got onboard Wi-Fi, you've got seatback video with hundreds of movies sometimes to pick from. I mean, these are things that didn't used to exist. Some of us of a certain age will remember the in-flight movie, as it was called.
And yeah.
It was, you know, projected on this blurry bulkhead screen, and you had these plastic earphones that dug into your ears, and it was, you know, it was a pretty crappy experience. In a lot of ways, it's better today.
Yeah. You write in the book about how a lot of people are scared to fly, but that's unwarranted. Planes are safer. And I guess terrorism, I mean, isn't as prevalent as it was, say, in the 1960s and 70s. I mean, you just go back to that era and you can remember hijackings and the sort all the time on the news, right?
Well, let's back up a second. People being afraid to fly, that's something we have to acknowledge and have to accept. And I think it's fair to say that everybody is on some level afraid of flying. And
right.
That's natural. It's normal. The problem is when it builds to a point where some people simply can't do it, and fear of flying becomes unmanageable. Moving on to what you were saying about terrorism, there's a whole section in the book about terrorism and our responses to it, about airport security and so on. You know, there's, as I refer to it, there was the golden age of air crimes back in the 60s, the 70s, and into the 1980s, when hijackings and bombings and airport attacks were pretty routine. I mean, there were days when you had multiple hijackings on the same day back in the 70s. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. Knock on wood, we don't see that anymore. For all of the talking that we do about terrorism and the fact that it's such at a high point in our kind of collective consciousness, luckily we don't have the numbers of bombings and other attacks that we used to have. And whether that's because of or in spite of our approaches to security is something we could debate all day.
Yeah. So on the issue of security, I was heartened by what you wrote about the TSA, because a lot of people have things to say about how security in airports are. There is a need for reform, and I think you call it in the book sort of mission creep, because it has been a number of years since September 11th. The role of the TSA needs to be looked at. It needs to be reformed, doesn't it?
It does, and this is something we could spend hours talking about. You know, the big irony, and this is something I bring up in the book, is that the success of the 9/11 attacks really had nothing to do with airport security. It was an intelligence failure at a much higher level than that, and yet we've put so many resources into you know, on the concourse airport screening, which a lot of which really just serves no purpose other than to inconvenience millions of people.
Yeah, there's a lack of common sense, isn't there?
There is, and ultimately people have to realize that keeping terrorists away from airplanes isn't the job of a screener on the concourse. It's the job of law enforcement and people working behind the scenes to break up plots and stop people before they get to the airport.
Yeah, there's a maddening anecdote in the book about you trying to bring a knife on board. If that can happen to you as someone who works on a flight, it happens to everybody, doesn't it?
Well, the number of ridiculous anecdotes, where to begin? There are so many of them out there. I mentioned some of the more humorous ones in the book, but they're also frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, a pilot in full uniform not being permitted to take a butter knife onto an airplane where there are probably 300 of those butter knives already on the plane.
Yeah.
Things like that just make your head spin.
Yeah. Yeah. And the knife that you were trying to bring on was from an airline, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah. What worries you about flying? I mean, you've done it for so long, since before the 90s, but since 1990 as a pilot himself. What are the things that worry you? I mean, we keep hearing about batteries in say our devices exploding or smoking up and causing fires. I mean, does that happen a lot?
No, it doesn't. It has happened, but it doesn't happen a lot. And then what worries me, that's an interesting question. You know, as a pilot, it's my job to worry. I'm supposed to worry about everything, I suppose, and you know, take that with a grain of salt, but there's an element of truth in there, too. Pilots have to be prepared and have to be conscious of the fact that things can and sometimes do go wrong.
How do you, so then how do you manage to, say, relax at all? I mean, and I'm not just talking about, say while you're working, but because you fly a lot for your work, and you travel, obviously, for leisure, when you're on a flight, do those instincts as a pilot, do they ever shut off, say?
I don't think so. You know, there are moments of low workload on any flight, and moments of higher workload, and so it ebbs and flows, your duties and responsibilities. But overall, as I was just saying, it's your job to be prepared, and then for just, you know, so many different possibilities and contingencies.
How often nowadays are say washroom smoke detectors, are they tampered with?
Yeah, one of my favorite parts of the never tedious pre-flight safety briefing is the command not to tamper with, disable, or destroy a lavatory smoke detector. I still don't understand how those things are different, and why we can't just say tampering with and leave it at that.
Uh-huh.
Aviation is all about extra words. How often does that happen?
Yeah.
Very infrequently.
Yeah, I guess people, I guess if one is a smoker, and I mean, there are cessation devices in the sort and patches that one can take on, especially on a long flight nowadays, that's not a problem. The other thing that's all I've always wondered about in terms of pilots and flight attendants, is it a good living? I mean, we hear things that as pilots especially, you know, make six figures in the sort. Is that true?
It depends which pilots at which airlines you're talking about. There's so much variation there. You know, pay for a pilot starting off at a regional carrier as a first officer can be surprisingly low. It's better now than it used to be, and it's improving generally. But it's still less than people think, where in comparison, a captain or even a senior first officer at a major carrier flying long-haul routes, you make a very good living. There's no denying that. Of course, getting to that point for most pilots takes a very long time. I was 35 before I was hired by a major carrier, finally, after years of making low pay at regional and cargo carriers. And that's after pilots invest sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars into their primary training. So eventually you can indeed make a very good living, but it can be a long time coming.
And for flight attendants, I guess that's the same thing too. You have to put in your time?
You do, and it's a similar story. Of course, flight attendant salaries don't top out at anywhere close to where pilot salaries do, and flight attendants tend to work more grueling schedules, more days per month to make ends meet.
So the thing that I've wondered as well is when, say, a flight arrives in a city late at night, that means that the entire crew is put up by the airline at a hotel, is that right?
That's generally true, assuming you're on a layover that's not your, as we call it, domicile. It's not the city you're based in. If you're based in New York and you're flying to Paris, when you get to Paris, absolutely, you have your accommodations paid for. And often, we're fortunate enough to stay in, you know, very nice downtown hotels in major cities around the world. And our layovers, you know, can range anywhere from 10 or 12 hours to 5 days. I mean, there's no typical layover. It really can vary. And occasionally, you can get multiple days in an exciting city somewhere and make a little vacation out of it. It's one of the great perks of the job.
I guess the other myth that we also hear about between pilots and flight attendants or cabin crew is a lot of hanky panky in the sort. Is that accurate, say?
I don't know. I mean, I think that sort of thing exists in every profession. I'm not going to say that it's more that there's more of it in aviation. Maybe to some degree at the regional carriers where people tend to be younger and single and on the whole, there's not a whole lot to talk about there. It's maybe not the 1970s anymore.
Yeah. The other thing that I was wondering about are the safety protocols in other countries, because a lot of people fly, say, in foreign countries. A lot of people worry, wonder if the safety standards are the same as they are, say, here in North America.
It's very close, and there's a section in the book where I talk about some of the myths and misconceptions about air safety in other parts of the world. There are some very safe, proud carriers out there from corners of the globe that you wouldn't expect. And I believe there's a list in Chapter 6 of airlines that haven't recorded any fatalities in at least, 30 years. And some of the names on that list would surprise a lot of people.
Yeah. And then the other thing, too, budget airlines, you write in the book that just because the price of your ticket may not be as high at a certain airline, that doesn't mean there's been a compromise, say, in safety protocols, right?
That's definitely true. I mean, airlines stand to lose so much should something bad happen. You go back to the ValueJet disaster in Florida a number of years ago. Things like that can destroy a carrier outright. It's also a bit of a myth that the biggest airlines have the best pilots. I mean, becoming a pilot is so competitive, and then so much of which carrier you end up at has to do with luck rather than talent or skill. You have very experienced, excellent pilots at some of the smaller discount carriers.
The pilot fatigue, because we've been hearing a lot about that in the news as of late, and of course, the films about pilots drinking, and you write in the book about suicide of one particular pilot that caused the plane to crash. Are pilots generally well looked after by the carriers in terms of their health or their mental health as well?
Well, you hit on several different topics there. You began with fatigue, which pilot fatigue has been an issue since the dawn of commercial aviation, and it's always going to be an issue. I think we're better at dealing with it now than we've ever been. And here in the U.S., a whole raft of new regulations was enacted a few years ago that have gone a long way towards alleviating pilot fatigue. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that fatigue tends to be more of an issue with short-haul flying than long-haul flying. Regional pilots flying several legs a day in and out of busy airports and then laying over for comparatively short amounts of time, that's very fatiguing. That's a very busy, sometimes stressful lifestyle versus getting on a plane and flying to Europe, one takeoff, one landing. Much more relaxed, more civilized. Of course, you have circadian rhythms and whatnot to deal with, but having done both styles of flying, I think for me, and everybody's physiology is different, of course, for me, the short-haul grind was more fatiguing than long-haul flying.
I guess the other thing that I was wondering as I was reading your book, because you do touch upon this in the book, and I found it fascinating, is because there's so much traffic in the skies, one wonders that there aren't... or one's surprised, I guess, that there aren't more, say, crashes midair.
Well, there used to be.
Yeah.
Ironically, when there were far fewer planes in the air, which is a testament to how our technology has evolved, the safety features that are in cockpits now to avoid collisions, as well as better air traffic control protocols. But not just in the respect of midair accidents, but accidents across the board. We see far, far, far fewer major plane crashes worldwide than we used to. We used to see 5, 10, a dozen or more every year. And now, certain catastrophes notwithstanding, such as the Malaysia Airlines incident and so on, we don't see that anymore. We've done so well at engineering out what used to be the most common causes of crashes. that nowadays, you know, relatively minor mishaps, you know, tend to be the big stories in the news, not crashes where you have, you know, 300 or 400 people being killed.
Yeah, there was a story that I'm sure you saw about the, I guess it was an Air Canada flight in San Francisco that I guess landed almost on the wrong runway, I guess one of the things I remember in the news story was that it was confusing, I guess, for the pilot in terms of that it was a takeoff runway rather than a landing one. What are some of the challenging airports for you in terms of taking off and landing? I mean, in North America, are there ones that stand out, say?
Well, first, I'm glad that you used the word challenging and not scary or dangerous or unsafe or any word like that. You know, we often see online or in magazines these lists of, quote-unquote, the 10 scariest airports or the 10 most dangerous landings. Yeah. There's no such thing. If any airport, if any runway was anywhere near being unsafe, no airline would fly there, period. What we do have are airports that are more challenging and more work-intensive than others, and that's perfectly normal. Every profession has its tasks that are sometimes harder than others, and that's what we're talking about there. And it can vary city to city, airport to airport, runway to runway, so it's hard to pick which ones exactly. Different airports can be challenging in different ways. Sometimes the hardest part of the whole thing is just taxiing.
Mm. Yeah. What are your favorites to say land into? I mean, I guess since I'm talking from Vancouver and we're always wondering about how we're perceived in the world, I mean, what do you make of our airport, say?
I'd be happy to answer that question, but I've never in my life landed at the Vancouver airport.
Oh, really? Really?
True story. Yeah. I'm a bit of an air travel romantic, I guess, so the airports I like tend to be the bigger international airports with you know, planes coming in from all around the globe, your London Heathrows, and then JFK, even in New York, for all of its downsides, is an exciting airport. Tokyo, Hong Kong, Bangkok, places like that.
You bring up Kennedy, which is a good example, because the three airports there, New York, Newark, Kennedy, and LaGuardia, often get you know, poor ratings in surveys and the sort. Why do you think it is for three important airports in that area, say in the world? Why do you think that they're perceived so badly?
Well, this is a big topic. You know, U.S. airports in general are, how to put this, kind of crappy. The bigger ones especially compared to airports elsewhere around the world. We just have all sorts of infrastructural problems and an unwillingness to pay for anything to fix these problems. And as a result, we've been overtaken by airports across Europe and Asia and elsewhere. The three New York airports in particular, where to start? I mean, they were designed and laid out decades ago for just a fraction of the air traffic that they have today. That's a big part of the problem.
Mm. And you write in the book about things that as to how airports could improve. And I guess around the world, are you seeing that reliance on public transportation, say subways and the sort? I mean that's a trend that I guess all airports need to say focus on in the future.
Definitely. That's one of the criteria that I always use when I grade an airport is accessibility to public transportation to and from the city. I don't want to say they're all inferior. The bigger ones tend to have their issues, but there are some smaller airports that are surprisingly pleasant. The new airport in Indianapolis, of all places. The Orlando airport. I could list several examples of smaller, but Raleigh-Durham is an example. The new terminal there looks like it could be in Munich or somewhere. It's quite a beautiful building. So with scattered exceptions, you know, I think our airports have a long way to go, but there are some decent ones, and public transportation is part of what makes an airport decent. I live in Boston, and we do have a public transport link to the terminals here. There's a good one in Washington, D.C., and a few others scattered around.
Yeah, I'm jumping around because there's just so much in your book, Cockpit Confidential, that I could talk hours with you about it. Air quality, because the air is recycled, say in the cabin. I mean, is it really better than we actually think it is? Say,
it is, and that's just one of the misconceptions that I write about. The idea that the air on planes is supposedly so filthy and germ-laden, when really it's actually very clean. People do get sick on airplanes. Normally it's from something you touch, not from what you breathe. And like I said, that's just one instance of people just not having the right information about something. And there's a section in the book, I think, in the introduction where I say something like, everything you think you know about air travel is wrong. And obviously that's being said with a grain of salt, but it's true that there are just so many different myths, misconceptions, conspiracy theories even out there, urban myths, and I try to take them one at a time and explain to people what the reality is.
Yeah, it's such a valuable book and such a great read. And I think one of the reasons why it did so well when it first came out, and why I think that this new edition, this revised edition, will do well again, is because it's a lot of stuff that we're wondering, a lot of stuff that we want to know about, that we need to know about. But I guess it speaks to just the knowledge gap out there and about the work that you do and about how planes work even. Do you think the airlines have done enough to, say, allay whatever concerns we have, whatever fears we have, say? And
I think some try better than others. I think carriers generally have a long way to go as far as communications, and this is something I talk about in Chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have this idea that the airlines will intentionally lie, and that's not true. Usually what happens is information gets passed from department to department to department, and by the time it reaches you, it's garbled up and it's not as accurate as it could be. That's a symptom of the way airlines are so heavily compartmentalized, and each department has its own lingo, its own language, essentially its own set of priorities, and so there's this garbling as information gets passed along during delays, in maintenance delays, things like that, and that unfortunately has fed a lot of the contempt and distrust that people have towards airlines.
Well, I think, Patrick, you've done a great service to the traveler, and I hope a lot of people, if they haven't read the first edition of this book, pick up this updated version, because, as I said, I was up with it for hours and hours and hours and telling people about stuff that I read in it. So congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Oh, thanks very much.
Thank you, Patrick. This will be up, as I said, later on, and I'm sure they'll pass on the link, or you'll see it on Twitter or something like that.
Okay, cool. And you guys can edit out that.
Yeah, well, we'll just fix the pauses and the sort. Yeah, that's all fine, yeah.
Good.
But otherwise, yeah, awesome. No, it'll be one shot, yeah. Thanks again.
Anytime, thank
okay.
you.
Bye-bye. The revised and updated edition of Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel, Questions, Answers, and Reflections, is published by Source Books. Also visit askthepilot.com. Patrick Smith joined me on the line from Somerville in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.